Hi, all of you wonderful scuba divers out there. Welcome to the Scuba Diving Magazine podcast, where I break down the latest scuba diving news and things that have piqued my interest over the past week. This week, we saw that we are no longer safe from Girl Scouts underwater, because they will find you and they will sell you cookies underwater now. And also news that Guadalupe is effectively closed indefinitely, so you can kind of reluctantly cross diving off there in off of your bucket list if you haven't done it already. But yeah, back to Girl Scouts. So yeah, this week Girl Scout cookie season has kicked off in America, and one local troop in Austin, Texas has actually submerged its cookie booth. So this is the nation's first Girl Scout scuba troop, which is Troop 40348, and it's hosting a one-of-a-kind underwater cookie stand at Dive World Austin on Saturday. So if you're listening to this after Saturday, sorry, but it's already happened. But if you're a scuba diver, they'd love it if you could head over there. They have a underwater cookie booth, and of course everything is weighted down to keep it down in their swimming pool. It's manned or hosted by some Girl Scouts, obviously, who are on scuba. And if you're scuba diving, then they have all the cookies down underwater. They're all in like sealed bags. They're all weighted down as well. And they actually put them underneath the shelves of their booth, so that because they're positively buoyant, they always want to float upwards. So if you are a scuba diver, you can go down, you can place your order, and you can take your cookies. If you're not a scuba diver, then they always have a system for that. They basically attach your order onto one of those underwater toy torpedoes that you have in like scuba diving pools. They attach it to that. They send it down to the girls, and then they prepare your order and then basically let go of it so it floats up to the surface and you can get your cookies. So yeah, just something a little bit different and a bit of fun. This troop does quite a lot of scuba diving, and they try to do things sort of with the girls that are scuba related, but also just like environmentally related. They do a lot of like river cleanups and things, and cleaning up their local waterways, as well as like coral restoration, all that good stuff. Over in Greece, archaeologists believe that they found the Temple of Poseidon. So the area where the remains were found was prone to tsunamis, which would make sense because Poseidon is the god of the ocean and tsunamis and whatnot. But archaeologists discovered remains of what they believe was the Temple of Poseidon near Samarkand in Greece. And the remains were unearthed. They're being researched by the Austrian Archaeological Institute together with researchers. And the location where they found these like remains underwater, it's well known to have been hit by multiple tsunamis in prehistoric and historical times. While it would seem that people would kind of avoid that kind of area, and especially like build temples, it could actually make sense why they would build a temple to Poseidon in this area, because they believe that he was the one that was creating the tsunamis, so that's why they built their temple there. But these remains, they were first found in 2021, but it was just like little bits and bobs and fragments and things. And it wasn't until a few months ago that archaeologists realized that they were most likely the remains of a temple of Poseidon. So they're heading back, and they're going to do more diving, more like archaeological and geo-archaeological analysis of the area over the next couple of years to kind of understand what's down there, what the structure was, and yeah, try and like really nail it down and go, yes, we think this is definitely the Temple of Poseidon. But that's kind of cool. And with any luck, there'll be enough like safe structure there that they can leave it there, and something that divers can go and explore, because diving around in the Mediterranean, there is a few bits and bobs, but it's not like laden heavy with dive sites. But if there's like an underwater Temple of Poseidon, granted it's not going to be something that you can dive like in and around, it will just be like the floor plans, as it were, I imagine. But yeah, just something a little bit different to explore underwater in that area. In other news, as I mentioned at the opening of the podcast, Guadalupe Island has been closed to all tourism operations until further notice. So Mexico's Environment Agency, which is SEMARNAT, closed the park in August of 2022. And then last week, the closure was updated and confirmed by the Mexican Navy to be indefinite. So the Mexican Environment Agency confirmed closure was due, in short, to the failure of some tour operators to follow the management plan for the island. The issue has become more political now, with both federal, state, and Navy interest being observed. Scientific study is allowed to continue in the area, but this is now going to be harder without the support of the tourism operators for shark researchers in the area. Now, short term, it appears that the Mexican federal authorities have cut their nose off to spite their face because, well, they're basically just decimating the tourism in that area. And the debate is, and the debate as to how sustainable and viable tourism at the island will become part of the legal and litigation process for the tour operators, the income generated from cage diving and how important it is for protecting the sharks in the area seems to have been forgotten, with the Mexican Navy stating they have the know-how and the resources short-term to protect the sharks. Now, this all seems to be stemming from They want to make sure that their shark population is safe and not being like injured. And one of their main worries is things like Shark Week, because they have like these entertainment shows that they come in and they film the sharks and then they edit it as if the sharks are like these terrible creatures or something. So they're trying to like minimize that. But in doing so, they're kind of like limiting the amount of people who are like legitimate and know that Shark Week is a bit rubbish, and they know that they just want to experience sharks in their natural habitat in the area. So we don't really know. And it's basically now in the hands of the Mexican Navy, who are basically going to say no to anyone going forwards. But now it's going into like Mexican government, and all the tour operators are going to be like going through the legal side of things and the arguments on both sides. And we don't really know. And not a great deal of information is coming out as well. What we could piece together, we had to piece together through a Spanish translation that we managed to get. And there's just very limited information that's coming out. All that we know is that, yeah, there's now this like ban on like people going into to dive in the area. So yeah, if you haven't dived at Guadalupe, and I haven't, I'm included, it might not be possible. So we don't really know exactly what's going on. Hopefully it will just be a flash in the pan kind of thing. And then they kind of assess things and they realize that actually, you know what, we do need tourism, but stricter regulations, making sure that the tour operators are doing things legitimately and they are like having the shark's welfare in mind. And yeah, let us go scuba diving again. But we'll know as soon as we see any kind of updates. I'm sure we will we'll notify you on scubadivermag.com. Over at DiverNet, Sharks Trust has launched a 5-project app. So the Shark Trust has launched a new smartphone app, which is designed to make it very simple for shark enthusiasts to get involved in science and conservation. It basically brings together 5 of its citizen science projects all onto one app to help users report both general shark and basking shark sightings, egg case finds, angling catches, and incidents of shark entanglements with marine litter, all on one app. So if you do see something, you can just jot it down and then they get all of that information, and it all goes into this like single database, which makes it easier for researchers to just get as much data and information as possible. So findings can be submitted from any part of the world. And each submission feeds into a personal contribution logbook of your own that's saved for sharing with the wider community, allowing users to see what others have been discovering in the local area. So if enough people use this app, then you can see, oh, Fred in the local area has been seeing a lot of whatever it is. I'd like to see that, I know exactly where to go. As further motivation, submitting to any of the projects unlocks a collectible shark card at random. So that's kind of fun. With 30 bronze, 15 silver, and 5 gold cert cards to collect. So I don't know, it's a bit like Pokemon Go, but for sharks, basically. So this is a UK-based charity. Their flagship Great Egg Case Hunt is on this app, and that encourages the public to find empty shark and skate egg cases on beaches or to submit those seen developing in situ on this app. And now it's celebrating its 20th anniversary this year, so you can help out with that. If you're scuba diving, you see some egg cases, or you're just walking the dog down the beach or something and you notice something, you can it basically has these pictorial like identifiers, so you can identify exactly which like species the egg case comes from. You can mark its location and basically help them with their scientific studies. Meanwhile, scuba divers and others based in Wales are being reminded to take part in Project SEARC, which is Sharks Inspiring Action and Research with Communities, which is aimed at safeguarding rare species such as angel sharks, tope, common stingrays, and spur dogs in the local area. So the Welsh coast has 26 of these species, but relatively little is known about their biology and their ecology. They just know they're kind of there. And the project was launched last February by ZSL, the Zoological Society London, and Natural Researches, Resources Wales, to remedy this, and with the help of citizen scientists of any age, so you can be contributing to this. The research is particularly concerned with the species of the IUCN Red List of Threatened Species, such as critically endangered angel shark and the vulnerable common stingray, and it's focused at two special areas of conservation, the Lynn Peninsula and Sarnau in North West Wales, and Carmarthen Bay and estuaries in the southwest. So if you do live in those areas, required input from the public ranges from basically learning to identify these egg cases to actually helping detect sharks in underwater video footage and scouring archives for historical information. So if you're in those kind of areas, you're diving in the waters or you're walking around the beaches and you do spot something, it really does help them to like mark those locations, the time, the date, all that kind of stuff, so that they can build a better library of like where they are most likely to be. Talking about things washing up on beaches, last week has been quite a bad week for like unusual species washing up, because we had a fin whale in Cornwall and a killer whale in Florida, both beaching. So the fin whale is the world's second largest animal. It was discovered dead, or this one particular one that a beach was discovered dead on Cornwall's south coast on Thursday. Marine experts from BDMLR and Cornwall Wildlife Trust have urged the public to help them find its carcass again after it was swept back out to sea overnight. So they are alerted at like 3 o'clock in the afternoon after a member of the public spotted what was believed to be a live whale ashore, and a small team of the Rescue Service Volunteer MMM, which is Marine Mammal Medics, attended the scene. And they said, whilst the whale was not very easy to spot, being some distance along the coastline on a headland and mostly still and submerged, only its head was really noticeable, having been forced up onto the rocks by the rough sea, while the rest of the body was very much in motion with the tide and the waves. Unfortunately, when we arrived, it became apparent that the 12 to 15 meter long animal was already deceased. It was far too dangerous to get close, so our team stayed back as a safe distance to assess it visually, collect photos and feedback information to our colleagues at Cornwall Wildlife Trust. So then it was carried out by the tides, but if it does like get carried and then gets washed back ashore, of course they need to know as soon as possible so that they can assess it, try and work out why it died and why it washed up where it did. But fin whales, yeah, they're pretty big. They can grow up to as much as 24 meters in in length and weigh up to 120 tons. But yes, they're very interested to try and find out the cause of death. They want to do a post-mortem examination on the fin whale, but because it's been washed away, they couldn't. And on the other side of the Atlantic, an orca has been found stranded on a northern Florida beach. And this is the first time such an occurrence has been reported in southeast USA. They don't tend to see a great deal of killer whales in that area, especially beaching. So the 6.5 meter long adult female died on the 11th of January, they believe, near the city of Palm Coast, although there are no obvious signs of injuries, according to Flagler County Sheriff's Office. Now, the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission staff helped marine biologists from SeaWorld to remove the body from the surf so that a post-mortem could be carried out to determine the cause of death. And orcas are usually associated with colder northern waters, but there's a small western North Atlantic population and another in the Gulf of Mexico itself that they believe it could be a member of. And now, of course, that they've managed to recover it, they can dissect post-mortem, see what's going on inside, because chances are it may have consumed some kind of fishing gear or pollution, food shortages, but at the moment they don't know until they kind of get inside and see what's going on. And sticking with that, a international team of researchers led by the University of Bristol has shown how dolphins' ability to work together is actually being hampered by human-generated noise, so boat motors and all that kind of stuff, which actually forces them to raise their voices in an effort to basically be heard over this new background noise. The scientists use suction cups to tag two trained and highly motivated bottlenose dolphins called Delta and Reese in a pen at Florida's Dolphin Research Center. And the aim was to record the two dolphins vocalizing and movement as they participated in a task that involved each one having to press its own underwater button within a second of one another. So it was a team skill that they had to do. So they had to communicate with one another. The dolphins would normally cooperate to achieve the task by communicating through whistles. However, as the scientists increased the external noise level, they found that Delta and Reese's whistles grew louder, obviously, and longer as they try to compensate. So it's like being at a train station or something, and a train's going through, and you're trying to talk to someone. You have to talk louder, and you have to really emphasize and talk, like, make it much more obvious for the other person to hear, so that you can be understood. And their success in performing the task decreased as the ever-increasing external noises. The study's lead author said, "For years now, we've known that animals can attempt to compensate for increased noise in their environments by adjusting their vocal behavior. Our work shows that these adjustments are not necessarily sufficient to overcome the negative impacts of noise on communication between animals working together. We had a unique opportunity to study the negative effects of noise on cooperative behavior in a controlled setting, something that's almost impossible to do in the wild. Our findings clearly highlight the need to account for how noise affects group tasks in wild animals. It also shows us that dolphins can flexibly modify their vocalizations in an attempt to continue cooperating with their partner, revealing that these species is capable of actively coordinated collaboration. We show that human-made noise directly affects the success of animals working together. If noise makes groups of wild animals less efficient at performing cooperative actions, such as cooperative foraging, then this could have important negative consequences for individual health and ultimately population health." So this has been a long, ongoing debate on background noise and just boat traffic and all of these military war games and things where they practice and they blow things up and they pretend to shoot one another as practice. All of this noise is just ruining these underwater species, and you often see it with sonar on submarines and things, because there's all of this noise that we're producing, and a lot of it is required. Granted, the world would probably ground to a halt if we stopped all boat traffic and whatnot, but if the, all of this like unnecessary like underwater noise was reduced or eliminated, then yeah, hopefully we wouldn't see as many like beachings, because we tend to see I forget what it was. It was the other year they had, and I think it was like military war games in a certain area, and then a week after suddenly they saw a bunch of whales beached up on a local beach. So there's this like tenuous link that they can't really specifically say, yes, it's definitely due to this, but it's like anecdotal. It's like, well, it's fairly obvious that it is. We just can't like scientifically prove that, yes, it's definitely sort of this. But this new study definitely goes to show that, yeah, it does affect their communications, and they do struggle when noise levels get too high. So we do need to think about our underwater noise presence in the water. Otherwise, there was some news about the Go Diving show here in the UK that was released. So tickets are now available, by the way, if you want to book it. It's early March, I want to say. But yeah, so Bruce is going to be sort of showing his face. Bruce is a like a bucking bronco, but it's like a kind of great white shark kind of shape. So that's going to be there, so you can ride on Bruce the shark. That should be good fun for both kids and grown up kids. And there's also going to be a virtual reality wreck dive. So this is for both scuba divers and non-divers. You can go on a virtual dive on a shipwreck. You have the headset and the two like hand controllers, and it basically allows you to descend down to like 70 meters to explore an underwater shipwreck. So if you've got a non-diver who's coming with you, or you just want to experience this pretty deep down shipwreck, then you can sign up for this and go diving at the Go Diving show. As far as new gear, I haven't seen a great deal. There was a little like release which was kind of interesting from Nortec, and it showed how their cylinder valves are slightly different. They use a different shaped like spindle on their valve handles. But other than that, I don't think I saw any new releases or any of the like sneak peeks or anything. Been fairly quiet this week. Maybe it's because it was Friday the 13th. They want to avoid that weekend. But as far as videos and projects that I've been working on, so the first one was someone asked me on YouTube about they keep bumping their head on their first stage and whether there's anything that they can do to help prevent that. So I've made a video from that. I don't think it's live yet. I think that's going to be going live next week. I could be wrong, but there are three or four things that you can do. The first thing is to look at the actual first stage regulator, because most first stages, when they're brand new, when they come straight out of the box, the manufacturer quite often assembles them so that they're, I'm trying to think of the best way to explain this audibly. A lot of first stages are shaped like an L, and they have the really tall bit set up as if you attach it with that pointing upwards. So that's just adding an extra inch or two, depending on the first stage design, of metal pointing up towards the back of your head. So what most divers do is they actually invert it. Now, this usually means removing hoses and then swapping them over to the other side, which isn't the end of the world. But it's typically something that I tend to do, and it helps to, one, just add an extra inch or take off an extra inch. So that's, every time you look up, you're not clonking your head on something solid metal. And it also helps if you're diving in an overhead environment and you swim into something on the ceiling. It means that the kind of the valve and almost like the butt of the first stage are clonking into it instead of like just the first stage. So now you're straining that join, but also it could like bump onto the section of the hose, which is much easier to break. It just protects all of that, and it keeps it a bit more like streamlined and in line. The next one is how high you have that cylinder attached onto your BCD. So a lot of divers, when they first like start up, they don't really know any different, and they kind of put that cam band of the BCD over the cylinder and then kind of let the BCD sit on the ground whilst they adjust the cam band. And that means that the cylinder is quite high up, whereas I used to teach it so that, you know, the sort of the skinny part of the neck where the shoulders of the cylinder becomes like the neck and then it turns into the valve, try and have that section level with the hardest point at the top of your BCD. So there's usually like a grab handle or something at the top of the back plate of your BCD, kind of level with that. And that way, your first stage, you can still reach it, usually by reaching over your shoulder, you can still reach the valve, but it's the first stage sits in like the crook at the back of your neck. So even if you do look up, then you're not going to bash your head on anything. Otherwise, simply adjusting your BCD, the shoulder straps, because if you have it tightened up all the way, then the BCD can ride up quite high on your back. Whereas if you loosen off those straps just a little bit, it just allows it all to relax down about an inch or so. So it's a bit further down. I read online, someone said, oh, well, I tend to dive with hoods anyway, so that's just an extra buffer, which, yeah, is a fairly good idea, but not really practicable in warmer waters, unless you just want to wear a hood to protect your head. But another one sprung to mind was the way that I was taught to dive with a dry suit, is that because you have that airtight, or at least watertight, mostly, neck seal around your neck, I was taught to never like turn just my neck. Try and look with your shoulders is what I was taught, so that you're not going to like risk slipping that neck seal just by looking either straight upwards, because then you're kind of stretching the neck seal, or looking side to side, because that neck seal can just... you pull on the seal and sometimes water can get in or air can get out. So just look with your shoulders, not with your neck, and just kind of have this stiff neck as if you're wearing a neck brace. And that can help, because then, yeah, you're not really just suddenly cranking your neck backwards to look straight up. And that can help you by just not doing that. So you're not going to crack your head on the first stage, but it tends to be on like deep water entry. So if you're doing a giant stride, then sometimes that can knock your head backwards. A rollback entry as well, you tend to be leaning backwards. So the natural thing is to kind of like look upwards, as it were, as you're rolling back into it. But the important thing is try and keep your neck stiff and like in line with your shoulders as much as possible. And that can help to prevent it. Another thing as well is I was told, and I'm not, it's one of those like old divers stories that you hear at the dive center that I used to work at. And whenever we were teaching giant stride entries, I was always taught as an instructor and like a dive master to always have my hand on their cylinder when the student is making a giant stride entry, because some people just... they don't do a giant stride, they just kind of step into the water and they forget that they have an extra like 6 inches of dive cylinder on their back. And if that clips the back of like the step, the hard section of what they're stepping off into the water, then of course that's just going to jam that first stage into the back of their head. And apparently this happened once, and this is why you're told to have your hand on the cylinder. So if they don't do a big enough step, you can just shove them a bit further forwards and then explain next time better that you have to make a giant stride into the water. But yeah, if you didn't know, that's why we call it a giant stride, so that you do step away from the platform when you don't hit the cylinder on whatever you just stepped off, and then it just gets pushed up and smacks you on the back of the head. One of the videos that went live last weekend was on how to equalize better. And because when I was teaching, especially, and for a lot of instructors out there, we tend to teach like one way to equalize your ears, but there are several ways of equalizing your ears. And it's one of those tricky skills that We can teach you, but we can't quite show you, because a lot of the things are going on like inside your throat and your jaw. So it's hard to like show what's actually going on. But at least if you struggle with a traditional like Valsalva, pinch your nose and blow, then there are other methods. And there are some things that you kind of have to do and kind of have to not do leading up to a dive as well to help improve your chances of equalizing better. Things like not letting seawater in and around your nose and mouth, because seawater actually makes your like tissues swell in those areas. So if seawater gets around that tube opening, then it can mean that you can't equalize just because it's all like swollen in that area. You can actually reach a certain depth where even if you equalize perfectly, you cannot equalize because the pressure around it is like holding that tube, because you basically got this soft tissue like tube tunnel. It's called the Eustachian tube, and one end that like leads to your throat is quite soft, and it's effectively closed. So what we're trying to do is force air into that area to inflate that tube basically and equalize that airspace. But if the surrounding pressure around you is so great that it's basically holding that opening closed, even if you equalize perfectly, there's no way that you can like fight that surrounding pressure. So that's why when you're taught to equalize your ears, one, do it early and often so that you don't reach that depth where you physically cannot equalize. But also, if you can't equalize, you then ascend and then try again. You're trying to alleviate that surrounding pressure so that you can equalize and then continue downwards. But yeah, there's just a few other ways. You don't have to pinch your nose and blow. I do the VTO, which is voluntary tubal opening, which is the like yawning method. If you kind of push your jaw out and downwards, it helps to like stretch those tissues, and it opens it up, and it just, it's hands free because you don't have to pinch your nose. Sometimes I still will pinch my nose just because it helps and it like covers all bases. But yeah, if you do struggle with equalizing at times, then there are other methods. Looking at questions that I've been answering. Someone asked a question about chlorine and dive equipment, because they, by the sounds of it, they're a member of a dive club, and they go scuba diving every so often during the month. But of course, they've invested in their own dive equipment, and they don't want to ruin it by diving in this chlorinated water. And they were asking, like, what does chlorine actually do to your dive equipment? And yeah, it's more like chlorine is quite nasty on dive equipment. The one thing that you'll notice is like the coloration of your dive equipment, it changes. It goes from like that jet black from when you first bought it to either like a dull gray, sometimes even white, but depending on the fabric, because there's a few different like Cordura materials that the manufacturers use, it can turn brown as well through age, and chlorine just basically accelerates that. Also on a lot of sealing surfaces as well, so O-rings and things, they tend to like delaminate. So if you do a lot of pool dives, either have a dedicated like set of pool equipment so it doesn't degrade your good stuff, as it were. But if you only have one set of equipment, try to wash and soak it thoroughly afterwards. So we used to have this training pool at the dive center I used to work at. They still have it. It's wonderful. It's indoors, 3 meters deep. It was heated as well to, I forget the number, I want to say like 30 something degrees Celsius. So nice, balmy, warm. You didn't need a wetsuit or anything, just a rash vest. But as soon as you'd get out, I'd go straight to the freshwater shower, like fully kitted up, and just kind of stand under that for about a minute or so, just to wash as much of that excess like chlorine off as possible, give it a real good soak in all the different areas, and then you can start to like break your kit down. But even after that, get it home, give it a good thorough wash in the bathtub with like warm soapy fresh water to get that chlorine out of the material, because it is quite nasty stuff. And it's this like paradox as well, because I used to have my pool mask, and forever had mold kind of growing. You get those little specks of black mold around the frame where the water kind of gets in between the silicone and the glass, and it just kind of stays there. And even though you're diving in this chlorinated pool just day in, day out, it doesn't kill it. So that's why the pool mask in particular, you could disassemble it. It was a Tusa, I want to say a Geminus, might have been a Seos. And with those, because they're designed to fit prescription lenses, you can disassemble the frame, you can take the glass out, you can take the silicone apart, and that way, yeah, you can really give it a good scrub and a good clean. So then you effectively have a mostly new mask, but a definitely clean mask, and also black skirts. You tend to see a lot of instructors, especially pool instructors, they have black skirted masks, just because even if the mold is there, you can't see it, so it doesn't look so bad. But yeah, that was another question that I was asked, and there are plenty more. I promise I am getting to them. It's this new format has kind of hit me for six, so it's, I'm not doing like five a week. I'm doing like two, maybe three a week, and because they're individual, it's a little tricky. But good news as well for a lot of people, we're not doing vertical anymore. There may be a couple more, but now they're going back to horizontal. There was strong resistance to the vertical videos. And on mobile, didn't quite understand it, because, yeah, I watch a couple channels that are in vertical. But on desktop, yeah, I get that. I get you don't want to watch a vertical video on horizontal. On desktop. But doesn't really matter. I prefer filming in horizontal anyway. It's much easier for me to edit it as well. I can fit more on the screen. So no worries. It's going back to horizontal. And there may be like one or two more verticals, but that's it. Once they're gone, they are gone. Otherwise, that's it. It's been quite a nice week for me. The weather's turned cold, though. It's nice where I live. I mean, I'm looking out the window right now. There's not a cloud in the sky, but there's frost on the road. I mean, my car almost slipped around a corner this morning, a bit of oversteer. But hey, I managed to control it. I saw my son up for his first swimming lessons. So that's going to be cool. That's going to start next week. To start off his underwater journey. Yeah, otherwise, nice, chilled. I got an email from Shearwater. They want to do some videos. I've got some stuff lining up. I'm still waiting on that DSX dive computer. It's I'm still kind of bummed that they sent all of their stock out to dealers. They didn't save one marketing copy for me to play with. So hopefully they'll be able to make a new batch fairly quickly, and I'll get my hands on one so I can show you. But yeah, otherwise, that's it for another week. Thank you for listening, everybody. And of course, safe diving.